This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
There is a major crisis unfolding in Venezuela as the regime of Nicolas Maduro clings to power and with some outside help. But the ramifications of this crisis are quite far-reaching. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we've been reporting on Venezuela for a number of months now, each time highlighting the fact that it's on the verge of civil war and being continuously surprised at how far that verge can stretch out things getting much worse this week with thousands of Venezuelans clashing with pro-government security forces in the streets. One of the key opposition leaders down there actually got a small band of military officers to defect and join his side and tried to stage a demonstration with some military support calling for Maduro, the president, Nicolas Maduro, down there to step down and resign. Maduro being guilty of vote rigging from an election at the beginning of the year and guilty of the running a dictatorial state that just decimated their economy, leading like now to over like 80%, maybe even up to 90% now of the people being in poverty. Mm-hmm. And so Maduro, as though he is not he's not going down easy. He's definitely rallied what military support he still has, put tanks into the streets. You can see video footage of tanks barreling into groups of protesters. At least 60 people have been killed in these clashes as he desperately maintains that he's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And while the other side of the government, primarily rooted in the National Assembly, is doing everything they can to make sure that he gets ousted from power.
And there's one outside power particularly intriguing in this equation. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. The big outside power in this major flare up is Russia. Actually, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, had announced that they actually had reports that Maduro was almost ready to leave. He had his bags packed, his planes on the tarmac, and was getting ready to hightail it to Cuba for asylum when someone from Russia called and made it known that they wanted him to stay put where he is and fight this out. Yeah, Russia and Cuba are being really like the main two sponsors keeping Maduro in power now. Maduro is sending Venezuela's oil resources to Cuba basically at cost in return for Cuban military officers that he will support his regime. And then Russia, who's also has close relations with Cuba, extending way back all the way to the 1950s communist revolution there, has also sent about 400 troops, according to the latest reports, to bolster the Maduro regime. They've moved in fighter jets, nuclear capable fighter jets. No concrete reports that that I've seen that they've actually moved missiles onto those fighter jets, but a U.S. Representative Michael McCaul from the House of Representatives was giving some testimony this week that the Russia is stronger in the Caribbean than any point since the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1960s, even saying that it is highly likely that they've already moved some nuclear weapons into Venezuela. But regardless of whether the nuclear missiles there are not, this is definitely the biggest military presence by Russia since we came just moments from World War III in the 1960s.
Yeah, it raises some really troubling questions. Just that we were talking, I guess, a couple of weeks ago when Russia first moved a few, I guess it was about 100 troops into Venezuela, the fact that it really doesn't have much to gain from this other than to have a show of force in America's backyard. It seems like they're provoking a fairly direct confrontation with the United States here.
Right, and there have been Russian MPs who've been fairly forthright about that after America started supplying Ukraine with diplomatic support and logistical support in their war against Russia, that the Russians view that as an American incursion into their backyard, and they wanted to repay America in kind by the Caribbean Sea being so vital to all America's trade. Like 50% of America's seaborne trade passes within 90 miles of Cuba. And so by using Cuba and Venezuela, whose governments are very intertwined, as like a focus of opposition against the United States, that is just a way for the Russians to poke America in the eye. Actually, it's kind of probably an unexpected development, not unexpected if you understand Bible prophecy, but unexpected if you don't, as this could even be a point that's kind of pushes a wedge between America and the European Union, pushing European Union closer into Russia's arms, and that the European Union has a lot of businesses, a lot of companies done in Cuba. I think it's Cuba's main trade partner, if you count the Union as a whole. Now, President Trump has come down and said that, well, because it's Cuban military officers keeping Maduro in power, he wants to, well, he's threatened to escalate his efforts against Cuba from sanctions to embargo, which right now, I mean, there's sanctions on Cuba, which means the U.S. isn't trading much with them, but European Union does. And so now he's talking about like using the power of the U.S. Navy to like enforce an embargo on Cuba. Like nothing comes in, nothing comes out until you get a new democratic government in Venezuela. Now, European Union's pretty upset about that because, like I said, they do have trade investments that they don't want to lose out on. They've threatened to take America before the World Trade Organization and sue them. And so that relationship's getting kind of heated as well. And so now you're seeing that, like, okay, well, Russia's got investments in the oil and energy sector in Venezuela and in Cuba. Europe's got investments in the oil sector and Venezuela sector and in Cuba. Europe's paid some lip service to America's effort to put a more pro-Western government into service, but by their actions they've shown that they're far more concerned about the dollars and the money they're making trading with these nations, same as Russia is. And so you could very well see in the near future actually Europe and Russia kind of kissing and making up and trying to come up some sort of deal between the two of them to secure their economic interest in Latin America and let America do what embargoes they want. They're the ones that are going to use the money, or at least so that line of reasoning would go, which does fall right in line with what things we've mentioned on this program many times about their verses, especially in Isaiah 23, Ezekiel 27, about a mart of nations, this economic alliance of nations against the United States, primarily led by Europe and Russia and China. And then also prophecies in Deuteronomy 28, particularly verse 52, which talks about this is a curse God says he'd levy on Israel if they disobeyed his laws, that like I'll besiege you in all your gates, I mentioned briefly earlier, about 50% of America's trade comes through two sea gates in particular, the Straits of Florida and the Yucatan Channel, both flanking either side of Cuba. And so if you've got a Russian power, a European power, or a Russian-European alliance that are dominating Cuba and Venezuela, then that gate can be closed down, and 50% of your seaborne trade does not make it to market.
Well, we're talking about a few steps down the road, but we're already seeing these dynamics that are developing from what's happening in Venezuela. Earlier on, the European Union was among the nations that took the same side that America did in supporting the opposition against Maduro. It's interesting to see how this is unfolding, where Russia really took a minority stance. It was one of the few nations that said that they would actually prop up the Maduro regime. Exactly how this plays out, it seemed like you said, that there were three or four times where it seemed like Maduro was likely to fall. It hasn't happened yet. The United States certainly seems to be taking they're very vigilant about what's going on down there, just hearing the language that's coming from National Security Advisor John Bolton and others in the Trump administration. But whether they have the will to follow through with some of those threats, I guess it remains to be seen. But we certainly are keeping our eyes very closely on what's happening there. We need to continue to watch that situation closely. We appreciate you bringing that story to us, Andrew. It ties in with the next story that we're going to talk about. What's happening in Venezuela is really part of a pattern from the leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin. An analysis published this week underlines what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been saying about this man for quite some time. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we just heard about Russia in Venezuela, and on the show last week, we spoke about Russian President Vladimir Putin's big meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and just how, how that shows Putin's determination to show the world that Russia is a major player. And this week, those two developments and numerous other ones were just kind of put into the larger context of Putin's great strategy and his vision in this, I think it's a very insightful analysis, published by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. So the article is called Vlad the Conqueror, and it makes a compelling case that basically you can understand everything Vladimir Putin does, all of his policies, inside Russia and outside, if you just keep in mind that he wants to make Russia great again, and that to him, great means powerful. Nothing more and nothing less. So inside of Russia, this is very clear with Putin's tightening grip on the media. The internet, for example, just this week, some laws were passed to give him all kinds of power over Russia's internet, maybe even power that will soon be on par with what Chinese leader Xi Jinping has there with the great firewall of China. And inside of Russia, Putin's also using the legal system to suppress dissent and to detain anyone who opposes him. There was a separate report in the Wall Street Journal this week showing that in the last 4 years, the ranks of political prisoners in Russia's prisons grew fivefold. So Putin is very powerful inside of Russia, and he's doing all he can to increase that power and prolong it. And then outside of Russia, Putin's not just working with Kim Jong-un or propping up Nicolas Maduro, so far away from Moscow as we just heard about there from Andrew. But closer to home, he is increasingly destabilizing Ukraine. He's taking more and more small slices of Georgia. He's also made Russia a major player in the Middle East, building Russian bases there and supporting the Syrian regime and the Iranian regime as well. He's making common cause with the president of Turkey. He is building partnerships with Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And Putin's doing all of this with an economy that's about half the size of the economy of the state of California. You know, it's remarkable how much he's able to do with what he has. This article says, quote, Russia has a per capita GDP lower than that of Portugal or Poland, and its defense budget has been shrinking. Yet its military is in the global top three. In this and other ways, Putin plays a weak hand well, end quote. And then the article, it ends with a really powerful takeaway. I think it says, quote, "Vladimir Putin has the morals of a KGB agent, the soul of a commissar, and the ambitions of a czar. He plays by no rules other than his own. His appetite for greatness, meaning power, only power, is insatiable. He will not be ignored. If you keep all of that in mind, everything he does makes perfect sense."
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments about what's happening in Venezuela? That's certainly one theater where Putin is getting under America's skin at the very least, and could be posing a significant threat that would be far greater than, like Andrew was saying, any that we've seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, I think the location of that particular Russian activity makes it more alarming for the U.S. than pretty much any of Putin's other forays and his other expansionist activities, just because it is in what has historically, traditionally been viewed as the U.S.'s backyard. You know, it's right across the Caribbean Sea from Texas there, and this increasing Russian presence, I think it's very alarming, and I think it's something that the U.S. should not sit idly by and just let this happen.
So this analysis really does align perfectly with what Gerald Fleury has been saying about this man.
Yes, yeah, it really does. It was back in late 2013 that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury first said that Vladimir Putin was fulfilling a very specific end-time Bible prophecy. He recorded an episode of The Key of David on November 13th of that year that was built around Ezekiel 38, verses 1 and 2. And those scriptures talk about a Russian prince, or a prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And Mr. Fleury said at that time that he felt confident that Vladimir Putin was fulfilling this prophecy, and that he would become only more dictatorial and more aggressive, which would end up troubling Europe. That's based on a prophecy in Daniel 11. And Mr. Fleury said Putin would soon bring many nations of Asia under Russia's control, under his control. That's prophesied there in Ezekiel 38 and also in Revelation 9 and 16. And at that time, in 2013, there were not too many indications that Putin was really dangerous on that level. You know, we had seen the invasion of Georgia in 2008, but there really wasn't that much to go on. But since the time that Mr. Fleury designated him this biblically prophesied prince of Russia, since that time, so many more troubling developments have happened, which this article this week, Vlad the Conqueror, goes through very powerfully. So I think it really does prove that Mr. Fleury's forecast about Putin was accurate. And it shows that we're in a dangerous new era with this biblically prophesied strongman on the scene here.
You know, it is remarkable how much Vladimir Putin has been able to leverage Russia's meager resources. But you look at those prophecies about Russia actually leading an Asian bloc of nations. Russia is certainly, under Vladimir Putin, is demonstrating an enormous amount of will, and it's amazing how much strong willpower is able to use whatever resources it has at its disposal to its maximum effect. But you put Russian will and leadership together with the muscle and the manpower that those other nations in Asia will provide. You have this great Asian bloc, this conglomeration, the Kings of the East, as it's referred to in prophecy, and you're going to have a formidable power over there.
It really will be. The Bible talks about the sheer size of that force. So it's not only under Putin's leadership, which I think was beautifully described in that article, you know, elements of the KGB agent, the commissar, the czar. It's not only under that kind of very willful leadership, but it also will have 200 million soldiers. That's what the scriptures tell us. So it's obviously going to have, you know, the Chinese military, probably India's, possibly Japan's, Korea's, you know, all of these nations. So the biblical picture there really paints a view of this that is sobering.
Well, we do have that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, on thetrumpet.com in our literature library. We'll also put a link to that in the show notes for the program today, and an article by Gerald Fleury, The Ukraine Crisis Was Prophesied. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. As we just heard, one region where Russia is exerting its influence is in the Middle East, specifically in Syria. An interesting story is emerging of cooperation between Russia, Syria, and the Israeli government. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
For the past 5 or 6 years, Israel has basically left the Syrian civil war to run its course without intervening too much, unless there was Iranian movement inside Syria or Iran trying to move forces or weapons inside Syria, and then Israel would act. But Israel largely stayed out of the political scene. If Assad went, fine. If Assad didn't, fine. We'll just see how this plays out. Well, we have some evidence now to show that Israel has worked with Assad over the past few weeks, and at least providing him with a goodwill gesture. This past week, Israel let two Syrian nationals return to Syria. They were detained. There were security risks, or as they were detained previously for security issues. But as some type of goodwill gesture, orchestrated by the Russians as the intermediary, Israel sent two of these soldiers home. And this comes after about a month ago, when Israel received, just before the election, remains of one of their soldiers back who fought inside Syria back 37 years ago. And Russia, again, acted as the intermediary to ensure that these remains of the Israeli soldier returned. And so we have this relationship that's developing. I wouldn't say it's an alliance of sorts, but you have Israel and Assad's regime acting on speaking terms, and the relationship being brought about by the influence of the Russians. Now, there is a column about this by Ben Caspit. He writes for El Monitor. He's a notorious Netanyahu hater. But in this case, he writes how we might be seeing the beginning of a not necessarily an alliance between Israel and Syria, but we might be seeing this type of relationship between Russia, Syria, and Israel, where those three nations are accepting each other's position in the Middle East, if that leads to a breakup with the Iranian regime. This is something we've spoken about for some time. Syria has been wedded to Iran for some time because they have preserved his regime, but Russia's involvement is really complicating that. Russia was called in, of course, by the Iranians to help out, and now that the Syrian civil war is dying down, both the Russians and the Iranians are fighting over the spoils, it seems, and the Russians seem to accept that Israel is the strong power in the region. And so if Russia wants to preserve its gains inside Syria, there is going to have to be some type of terms that are worked out between Israel and the Syrian regime. And just one quote from this article now by Caspit. He says this: despite Israel's frequent attacks on Iranian targets in Syrian territory, according to foreign reports, there are no direct conflicts with the Syrian ruler himself. On the contrary, many high-level Israeli figures have maintained over the last 2 years that Assad knows that he has a lot to lose from the Iranian presence on his territory and agreed to it only under pressure. He is loath to pay Israel the price for that presence. Could it be that the Israeli-Syrian deal was designed to mobilize Assad to leave the Iranian camp for the Israeli side with Russian encouragement? And that's interesting, because that's what we've expected. Not necessarily Russia to be involved in Syria, but for eventually this civil war to end up with Iran on the outside looking in.
Right, and we wouldn't have expected Israel to be a player in that equation either. But the split between Syria and Iran, that's something that is definitely strongly indicated in prophecy.
Right, yeah, we know based on Psalm 83 that the Syrian nation, which is made up mainly of the biblical Hagarenes, that's a territory they were dwelling in. That Psalm 83, talks about the Hagarenes being in alliance with other moderate Arab states, if we can call them that, but not in the Iranian camp. And so we knew from the very beginning that Syria would end up on the outside. But Israel has shown itself to not back down in terms of allowing Iranian entrenchment in Syria. And so they've proven that through over 100 attacks inside Syrian territory against Iranian installations over the past couple of years. So if Syria is going to have any peace for the future, they know that they can't have a long-term relationship with Iran using its territory, Syria's territory, as a base for operations against Israel. And so it looks like we're starting to see that switch here with Russian help.
Brent, if listeners want more information about this, where would you send them?
They can read an article that was published this week. It's entitled Battle for Influence in Syria, Russia versus Iran. It also details another news report a couple of weeks ago that saw Iranian forces fighting against Russian-backed forces as well. So that those cracks in that relationship are becoming clearly visible.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Over to Europe now, and a couple of stories highlighting the continuing rise of the far right. For this, we'll turn to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, I feel a bit like a broken record here coming on and talking yet again about a milestone result from a far right party in an election. Once again, here we are talking about how this time in Spain, you've had an unprecedented result. This time it's Vox, and it's the first time a far right party has made it into Spain's parliament in their democratic history, you know, since they got out from under the thumb of General Franco back in the 70s. And you know, a lot of people kind of saw Spain as one of the places most resistant to the far right because of that recent history of a dictatorship. But they won 10% of the vote, so not necessarily, you know, massive compared to some of these other countries, you know, like Finland we were talking about a few weeks ago, or the Netherlands, or even East Germany, where a poll very recently showed that the Alternative for Deutschland were the single most popular party, but still a milestone result. And it's the same trend now where the Socialist Workers' Party in Spain did better than was expected, but still there's no easy coalition that they can form. Neither the mainstream left nor the mainstream right are able to form a kind of stable coalition on their own, and so Spain is looking to yet another unstable coalition government, something they've struggled with for several years now.
So why the popularity of this far-right party?
Because everything else is failing, I guess. Is, you know, you've had in Spain, you've had failed coalition after failed coalition, governments falling apart over a matter of weeks. At the same time, you have some of these big issues that none of the mainstream parties will talk about, things like the rise of migration. You've had the economic crisis back in 2008, and that's left a lot of people feeling like mainstream politicians don't care about them and don't sympathize with their problems. And so they're turning to some of these extreme solutions.
So you mentioned how this same trend is playing out in other European nations, and looking at the broad picture in Europe, we have a fairly sizable section of the populace that is finding a lot to like about some of these parties that have really been I guess on the fringe in the past and are opposed to the kind of mainstream liberal type parties that have built Europe over a period of generations. And when we look at prophecy, we can see that that segment of the European populace is going to continue to grow and will actually find a leader who's able to address the concerns that they have. Maybe you could give us, first of all, there was another story that you were looking at that mm-hmm. showed a similar type of sentiment taking place within another segment of the European population, and then we can talk about the prophecy.
Yeah, you're seeing a rise in extreme opinions, and you're seeing that's really reflected a rise of anti-Semitism, which, of course, brings back horrible memories from Europe's past. Now, we're talking about a trend across an entire continent. So not every single party is anti-Semitic mm-hmm. that's part of this kind of this rise of the fringe. But a significant number are. And there was a poll from Austria that really had some startling results. 58% of Austrians said that they believed something like the Holocaust could happen again in other European countries. This was by the Conference on Jewish Materials Claims Against Germany. Published to kind of coincide with Holocaust Memorial Day. They found that 38% believed that National Socialism or Nazism could come to power again. 40%. 43% among millennials. Sorry.
That's a huge number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 27% said they believed that the Jews could face another mass genocide. With, I guess, 35% said they disagreed, 38% were neutral or weren't sure. And this was a pretty comprehensive study. They studied 1,000 Austrian adults via phone and online interviews, and you know, they came up with some really startling figures. Another one, this time also published to coincide with Holocaust Memorial Day, from the AP, they wrote, anti-Semitic attacks spike, killing most Jews in decades. And they talked about how assaults targeting Jews rose 13% in 2018. That's according to Tel Aviv University. They talked about some of the attacks that we've seen in America even recently. But they wrote the spike was most dangerous in Western Europe, where Jews have faced even greater danger and threats. In Germany, for instance, there was a 70% increase in anti-Semitic violence. They quoted Moshe Kantor, the president of the European Jewish Congress, saying that there is an increasing sense of emergency among Jews in many countries around the world. It is now clear that anti-Semitism is not limited to the far left or the far right and radical Islamist triangle. It has become mainstream and often accepted by civil society. He talked about how anti-Semitism has entered gradually into the public discourse. Threats, harassment, and insults have become more violent. And so you're seeing this rise in anti-Semitic violence. You're also seeing this trend where it's becoming increasingly tolerated for people to just talk anti-Semitically openly in polite society and not be shunned or ostracized or condemned for that. So you know, multiple different data points, but you're seeing this trend of extreme behavior becoming the norm in various different ways, especially in Europe.
Well, I would imagine that it's these disparate data points that you're referring to that are creating this sense of alarm among a sizable segment of Europeans. It's not necessarily that they would, you said like 58% said that something like a Holocaust could happen again. 38% believe that the Nazis could come back. They're looking at the way that people are treating Jews. They're looking at the rise of this more radical type of brand of politics and saying, really, we're not that far from seeing these types of trends emerge on a broad scale and to an extreme that the continent hasn't seen in generations. It's quite extraordinary, especially when you view it, as I said before, in light of the prophecies of the Bible.
That's right. I mean, the Bible talks about this empire in Europe that rises repeatedly, that goes underground, that comes back again later. And the most recent example of that empire was the Nazis under Adolf Hitler. And when that fell, Herbert W. Armstrong said, you know, they'll be back. This spirit isn't dead. It's going to go underground, but it's going to reach the surface again. And what you see is that with these kind of figures is, yes, that spirit of Nazism and that spirit of, well, basically the Holy Roman Empire, this power that has risen repeatedly, it's not there. It just went underground, and it is increasingly breaking the surface these days as it's rising right back up. He was saying right in 1945, you know, you're going to see this come back again. Now, fast forward 60, 70 years, and you're seeing 58% of Austrians saying, well, yeah, it could be coming back again. 40% saying Nazi National Socialism could come to power again. They can see the potential now for this to rise right back up again in exactly the way that Herbert W. Armstrong said that it would.
What would you say would be the best source to look at to get more information about this subject?
If you want to just see a bit more news along the lines of this spirit coming right back up again, Joshua Michels had one of our most read articles of the week, Did Germany Ever Learn the Lessons of the Nazis?, where he just points to some quite startling comments that come from some secular journalists warning that you're seeing more and more of this kind of Nazi spirit rising in Germany. But then to really see the Bible trends behind this and to understand why Herbert W. Armstrong made those forecasts, you really need to read our book, He Was Right. And that gives you an overview of everything that he said, really, an overview of the globe, you know, where he got these prophecies from, and then just takes you through instant by instant to show how those prophecies have already been fulfilled in so many cases. And then, of course, so many of those prophecies revolve around this empire rising in Europe. And so that's that free book, He Was Right.
Excellent. I appreciate that very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we will give you an update on the catastrophic flooding in the American Midwest and also talk about why Joe Biden is wrong to say that China is not a threat to America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Flooding in several states in America's Midwest has been devastating. This is a story that hasn't received much mainstream press, but the fact is the problems are getting worse. To learn the latest about what's happening, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they had some of the worst flooding in Midwestern history about a month ago, with just huge swaths of farmland being inundated with water, and it is getting worse. The Mississippi River has been creeping up towards the levees, has been for weeks, and finally on Tuesday of this week, those barriers broke, sending waters rushing into the residential areas beyond, forcing businesses to close and people to flee their homes. There are about 30 people who didn't make it out in time, got stranded, didn't drown, but had to be rescued by firefighters. These rains are continuing, and some of the storms that have generated them have even also generated some very powerful tornadoes that have swept across Nebraska, Iowa, even some here in the northern part of Oklahoma. And but one of the more sobering aspects of this story is back at the beginning of the month, on April 7th, the flooding had gotten so bad by that point that the governors of both Iowa and Nebraska declared April 7th as a day of prayer for flood victims, saying that these prayer can provide peace and guidance to those who have been profoundly affected by these horrible weather conditions. Governor Reynolds, Kim Reynolds, even saying that throughout our history, Iowans have united in prayer to God to ask for strength and steadfastness in times of difficulty. So this is the governors of two states calling for a day of prayer because of this this catastrophic flooding that's devastated their agricultural sectors, devastated their residential areas, and now we're almost 4 weeks, through about 3.5 weeks out from that, and the levees broke, the storms unleashed, the hurricanes, tornadoes have come through those states, and so it's pretty obvious that those prayers have not been answered. And there's a reason those prayers have not been answered. In our show notes today, we have an article from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, Is God Answering America's Prayers? And he wrote this last year sometime when a similar thing happened with hurricanes on the coast, where you had Hurricane Harvey come in, devastate Houston, Texas. Both the governor of Texas and President Trump called for a day of prayer, and then they had another hurricane hit Puerto Rico and another hurricane hit Florida right shortly after that day of prayer, showing that then as now, those prayers were not answered. And in his article at the time, Mr. Fleury pointed to a verse in 2 Chronicles, chapter 7, verse 14, which is a promise God made to the Israelites. They said, "If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sins and I will heal their land." And that verse is specifically in the context of weather disasters like droughts and floods and things mm-hmm. like that. And it's a promise from God that if you pray, humble yourself, and turn from your wicked ways, I'll heal the land. And so if you're unless you believe God's a liar, you have to realize that one of those three things hasn't been done. It's definitely not the praying part, because they had the leaders of two states declare the National Day of Prayer, but there's a conditional statement there about humbling yourself and repenting and turning from the evil you've done. That's why the curses come in the first place, not that a particular farm that gets flooded out is inhabited by a person who's more evil than his neighbors there. But God uses events like this to get
the nation's attention.
Yeah. Now, and there's a lot of people that will in America today that mock the idea of prayer. So now here are some religious people who know that something's wrong and they need to be praying about it. But without that repentance aspect of it, that verse doesn't carry through. And Mr. Fleury even remarks in his article about a particular politician who quoted that verse and omitted the part about turning from your wicked ways, because that's not a great vote getter. To my knowledge, I think Abraham Lincoln was the only U.S. president who was able to run a campaign of repent of your sins and actually get elected with that message. Mm-hmm. Normally, there's more of an aspect of flattery when you're looking for votes. But flattery aside, like I said, this is a promise from God. People are doing their praying, and the weather disasters just keep coming. So it is time to ask yourself, like, what ways do we have to turn from?
Yeah, that's very good. I'm glad you reminded us of that article by Gerald Fleury, and we will put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Is God answering America's prayers? A very important question that we really need to be thinking about in light of these disasters. Thank you for that, Andrew. American presidential politics are in full swing, particularly among Democratic presidential hopefuls. This past week, the man who appears to be the front runner made some comments about China. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was pretty big news when former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden announced last week that he'll be running for president of the U.S. coming up here in 2020. And this week, he was at a campaign stop in Iowa, and he made some statements about China that I think are, they're worryingly naive. And these statements are, it's not just him. I think this is indicative of how just the way that many Americans and many other Westerners are not really aware of how much power China has amassed in recent years, and just how dictatorial the Chinese Communist Party has become, and you know, just how real the threat there is. So Mr. Biden told the crowd there in Iowa that there isn't a single world leader who would trade the problems that the U.S. has for those that China has. And then he said, quote, China's going to eat our lunch. Come on, man. And then from there, he just painted a picture of China as being so consumed by domestic and regional problems and so riddled with corruption that it doesn't pose a real threat to the U.S. It seemed to me that he meant, you know, economically, militarily, every other way, China's just kind of a joke.
It seems like you have to be have your head in the sand not to recognize how many different ways China is vaulting itself into a major power to be reckoned with in the world as it is today, economically, militarily, politically. As you said just at the beginning there, it seems like this reflects terrible naivety.
Yes, and I think it's worth talking about because it's not just Mr. Biden who thinks this way. With many onlookers, especially those who have been around a little longer, the view of China sometimes seems to be a little bit stuck in the 1960s or 70s. At that time, China really was ridiculously far behind the developed world. It was barely industrialized. It was mostly agrarian, had a laughable military, And then even after the big opening up of China under Deng Xiaoping there in the late 70s, even after that, as far as the world was concerned, China was a good place for cheap labor, but it didn't have much else to offer. But the thing is, China very, very rapidly matured and developed. In 2010, it became the world's second largest economy, overtook Japan there. There's one just mind-blowing statistic that often comes up showing this. It's that China produced and used more cement between 2011 and 2013 than the U.S. did in the entire 20th century.
Wow.
So in 3 years, you know, there's also a well-known picture that circulates just comparing Shanghai in 1987 to Shanghai 25 years later, 2012. And it really goes from this just kind of a sprawling, unimpressive, one level, you know, city that's barely developed to very suddenly being this collection of the most futuristic looking skyscrapers just reaching up into the sky there. And there are just so many other mind-boggling statistics about how fast that transformation happened. Right now, Chinese railways could go around the world twice. Mm. They chop down 20 million trees a year just for their chopsticks.
Yeah.
And then militarily, they have unbelievable cyber attack capability that we're only beginning to learn the real, you know, the real capacity of. They have missiles that can knock out satellites, which they've proven. They have missiles that can sink a U.S. aircraft carrier. You know, their Air Force has 3,000 planes. So by the time Xi Jinping became president in 2012, China was primed for a strongman to come in there and just to begin to lead it with some real determination. And now here we are 5 or 6 years on from that, and China's very powerful. And it's bent on ending the era of U.S. world dominance. So I think to see a man who wants to become the next president of the United States just totally unaware of this and kind of laughing it off, it's pretty, you know, pretty sobering to see that.
Yeah. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes to an article by Gerald Fleury called China is Steering the World Toward War, that really puts what's happening in China in its prophetic context. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Back to the Middle East now. Events show just how fraught the relationship is between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Any reporting you've heard on this subject, Saudi Arabia, that is, from the United States, I'd say over the past decade, has been pretty antagonistic and not very positive, especially since the Obama administration was pursuing a deal with Iran, Saudi Arabia's known adversary. And that the reporting has kind of continued into the Trump administration. There's a lot of reporting about the Yemen war, where Saudi Arabia is painted out to be the bad person or the bad actor in this. Even I think Congress and the Senate voted to try and stop the president from pushing forward, from supplying Saudi Arabia with help with that war. And what's interesting is that all of this negative attention comes at the very precise time that Saudi Arabia is fundamentally transforming from a state that backed radical Islamic clerics that pursued that kind of bred the terrorist organizations of Al-Qaeda to a state that is kind of denouncing that right now. Now, there was a very important piece in Bloomberg View by Dennis Ross. He was a former U.S. official, I think, during the Bush years. And he just visited Saudi Arabia. And this is what he said, quote, "Saudi Arabia is in the midst of a fundamental transformation of its society and of the sources of the regime's legitimacy." He says, "True, the monarchy retains all political power, but nationalism and modernization are replacing Wahhabism, that's the form of Islam that produced Al-Qaeda and such, and it's the doctrine that the United States and its allies have been fighting around the globe. And the author of all of this is the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman." Now, we've talked about this man before. He is a younger figure. There's still King Salman there that's in power. And yet, we've got a revolution on our hands in Saudi Arabia. And it seems to be a good one away from the radical Islamist camp. And yet, you don't really hear much about that in the United States.
And just put it in prophetic context for us, Brent.
Well, it's interesting because we know that the the head of the radical Islamist camp is Iran. That's what the Bible talks about, and our editor-in-chief has forecast for the past 30 years. And up until this point, you had a lot of Sunni elements that fostered terrorism coming out of the Saudi Arabia, and even the government there that favored a lot of its clerics, that held them in higher esteem, that pushed that form of radical Islam. And now we've got a situation where we have Saudi Arabia losing its steam in forms of Islamic terrorism, which is leaving Iran as the only state sponsor of terrorism out there. It's interesting because we know that Saudi Arabia, in biblical prophecy terms, is going to side with the European Union, a German-led Europe, as well as some more moderate Arab states in an alliance that is going to be used potentially against Iran, or at least an alliance that's counter to Iran's radical Islamist camp. And so if Saudi Arabia has this fundamental transformation, a relationship between Europe and Saudi Arabia becomes far more likely, and it also will push the radical Islamic members or those elements inside Saudi Arabian the nation, and also others that have looked to Saudi Arabia for leadership, into the Iranian camp as well, as that would only be the only state sponsor that is holding for a let's say Islamic terrorism. And so it's kind of fulfilling both prophecies, or pushing the fulfillment of both of those prophecies.
And both of those are explained in our booklet, The King of the South, which is available on thetrumpet.com. Thank you for bringing that to us, Brent. As we wind the program down, we'll finish with an update on British politics after a particularly ugly week. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we continue to see the fallout from Brexit this week. Just yesterday, we had local elections in the United Kingdom, and these were really the first elections that we've seen since everything has been going on with, you know, Theresa May's deal not going through and all of these kind of things. So, you know, the public get to pass their verdict now on how the main political parties, how Britain's leadership has handled leaving the European Union. And the results were pretty abysmal. Both the Labour and the Conservative Party lost badly. The Conservative Party, being the party of government, lost the most. They've lost over 700 seats as of now across all of the different local councils. Just to kind of put the number in context, they've won about 2,000 seats. So more numbers are going to be coming out throughout the day. But you're looking at a significant percentage of fall in seats there for the Conservatives. The Labour Party as well, though, have lost seats. They've lost around 90, which... you typically, an opposition government at this, or an opposition at this stage in an election cycle, would expect to do really well in local elections. It's a bit like midterms in the US. They've done badly as well. Instead, you've had a surge of support for others, for independents, for the Liberal Democrats, who were a bit of a non-entity last time around in local elections, for the Green Party. I think one headline in The Telegraph put it best. They said if none of the above were on the ballot, they would have won. And that's pretty much... what you saw is both the established parties, you know, everyone just hated. Also this week, just another development that just seems almost inexplicable. It's hard to comprehend, but Prime Minister Theresa May has made the decision that she wants to invite Huawei, the Chinese internet giant that, you know, like all big Chinese internet companies, or all big Chinese companies, works hand in hand with the Communist Party, essentially a hostile nation. She wants to invite this company in and build the backbone of the 5G infrastructure, so the next generation of Britain's infrastructure. So she's inviting a company that the United States is going around the world warning people not to do business with. It's a company that Australia and I think Canada now are looking at refusing to do business with because they have been known to spy on any nations that they have done business with. You know, to come in and invite them in to play a critical part in building Britain's infrastructure. This decision has caused a lot of outcry. Then someone in her inner circle leaked the fact that she was doing this. She was trying to do this deal without telling the public, apparently, and trying to keep the public from knowing what was going on. The decision was leaked. Then she fired someone for leaking it, even though there doesn't appear to be much good evidence that they were actually responsible for it. And the result just really adds to this perception that everything at the top of Britain's government is an absolute mess. And you know, this lack of leadership really does tie in strongly to Bible prophecy. I mean, one of the proverbs that we don't end up necessarily quoting the proverbs all that much on this show, but one of the ones we do quote a lot is, where there is no vision, the people perish. And perhaps that could be a bit abstract. And I think in Britain, we see exactly what that looks like. We have a government that doesn't know where to go, doesn't know what to do. When it comes to leaving the European Union, they have no idea where they want to go from here and have just kind of resorted to, you know, Parliament was offered all of these different options. Do you want to leave the European Union this way and this way and this way, and said no to everything? There is no strong leader there setting out a vision for Britain's future, and you're seeing the government just almost implode. Fraser Nelson, the Spectator's editor, he had an article this week talking about how time and again he wrote, we come back to the same problem, the vacuum in number 10, the vacuum at the top of Britain's leadership. And that was specifically prophesied. You know, Isaiah chapter 3, where God says exactly, yeah, I'm going to take away all of your great leaders. I'll take away the eloquent orator, the politician that can stir the country behind a strong vision. And we're seeing exactly what that looks like with the chaos week after week in the UK, whenever it comes to Brexit, local elections, decisions regarding the internet, just about anything. Repeated chaos and indecision.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of James Freeman Clark. A politician thinks of the next election, a statesman of the next generation. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.